session number 27075, reel 25.
Squadron Leader Leggett, reel 25. You were mentioning about explosive cannon shell.
Yes. Obviously, one never knows what it was that did the real damage. One would imagine that an explosive shell could be quite lethal, though it would depend on the type of target, of course, and just how accurately one had been able to hit it. But one didn't know. One just pressed the button, and whatever happened to come out, one hoped was going to do some damage. But I would have thought that the ball probably would have the more lethal effect.
Equipping an aircraft with cannon, would that affect its performance as well? Was it heavier than?
Yes, okay. Yes, they are somewhat heavier. And the feed, the ammunition feed mechanism is fairly chunky stuff. It made the aircraft a little bit heavier on the aileron control. That was fairly noticeable because we got these four guns out in the wing, two on either side. So yes, the response to the controls would have been just that little bit slower, but not noticeably so. But it was there. I think it's probably true to say if you put up a couple of Hurricanes, one with four cannon and the other with eight machine guns for a dogfight, I dare say the eight machine gun one would outturn the cannon one. I think it probably would. But I never actually put it to the test.
And were you equipped with the Hurricanes until the end of the campaign in North Africa?
Yes, right through until, yes, until Tunisia was taken and the whole of the Africa Corps then collapsed.
What was the feeling amongst the squadron at that time? Obviously the campaign had finished in North Africa.
Well, it was... It was one of relief, I suppose, is the best word, because for as long as you had got Rommel and his army in the desert, there was always a threat, and we learned never to underestimate the Africa Corps. And I think it's fair to say that for as long as they were there, there was always the possibility that one night we might wake up, as we did at El Adam, although I wasn't there at the time, but they woke up in the middle of the night to hear tanks rumbling around on the far side of the airfield, or it sounded like that. In fact, they were some miles away, but the Africa Corps were working their way round to the south, and everybody had to get out jolly quickly. So that sort of situation was always in the back of one's mind, and for as long as they were there, and there was open desert to the south, and there was always open desert to the south, that they might have a go and try and work round once more. So it was nice to know that wouldn't be happening anymore. There was all sorts of other things to come on later on, but at least that particular situation no longer obtained. So then we sat back, I'm quite sure. We were able to lead a rather more civilized life. We had the big city of Tunis, about 10 miles away, We had the ancient city of Carthage, a couple of miles up the road. We had some lovely swimming beaches a little bit further on the other side of Carthage. And life was very agreeable. And one day the boss pulled us all together and said, we are re-equipping with Spitfires. Jubilation all round.
Can I ask you about that? Because obviously you've explained all through the tape about how you'd work with the Hurricane.
Mm.
How was the Hurricane seen by 1943, really? Was it coming to the end of its operational career?
Well, it was. Back home here in UK, very much so. Although they did continue on as Harry bombers right through into Normandy and so on. As far as I was concerned, I was still perfectly happy with the Hurricane. It was an aeroplane I knew and could rely on. Its rigidity has saved my neck more than once. And I was very happy with it. The Spitfire to me was an unknown quantity. I'd always had this Hurricane loyalty from my early days, and I always had the idea that the Spitfire was a rather delicate little thing. First time I saw them close quarters was at Montrose when we had a flight of Spitfires on the airfield. And I always thought that the dainty little undercarriage on the Spitfire wasn't the best undercarriage in the world, whereas the Hurricane was rugged and you could plop a Hurricane down almost anywhere. So I was, although I was quite excited about the idea of transferring to Spitfires, it wasn't a case of glad to see the back of Hurricanes. As I think some people did have reservations. I know in particular Tom Neal in one of his books. He says what a horrible aeroplane it was, mind you, he had due course. He had five engine failures. But he still lives to tell the story and write books all about it. Have you read him? Read him? It was Tom Neal.
So what was the Spitfire that you were re-equipped with? What model?
Oh, it was a 5B. Those up there.
Could you give me an impression of the 5B, as you've done with the Hurricane earlier on? Give me an impression of the aircraft and its capabilities and its layout.
Yes, well, clearly it's a pretty aeroplane in the air. There's no question about it. It's a very, very pretty aeroplane, beautifully conceived and designed, and in so many ways. An enormous leap forward in aircraft design, fighter aircraft design. To fly, well, yes, there was no question about it. It flew very, very well. I don't know that there was such a huge difference between the two aircraft. It wasn't a case of chalk and cheese by any means. They were just rather different. I must say the Spitfire cockpit was very nice. It wrapped itself around one. Visibility on the whole was that much better. Handling, it responded very well. Aileron control, I think, yes, was probably better. Response to the throttle was very good. Taking off was no problem. She leapt in the air quite happily. Good rate of climb. Approaching the airfield and landing, you did have to be careful with that little undercarriage. You had to be, you had to put it down fairly gently. You couldn't chuck it on the ground. You had to put it down fairly gently. Taxiing was a nightmare. You got that great big nose sticking up in front of you, and you just couldn't do a darn thing. I mean, even a big thing like a starter trolley, you could quite easily just taxi into it without seeing it. So you did have to be careful. You had to jink the whole way. You were taxiing. But once you'd done your bit of taxiing and switched off, there she was in one piece, pretty aeroplane. Yes.
What was she armed with?
We had two cannon and four machine guns, which is a nice armament. It was, I think, it was probably the best of the armaments. As I said before, the four cannon did have a tremendous punch, but so had two cannon. You could knock an aircraft out of the sky with those two cannon and the machine guns. Mm.
You mentioned visibility. Was the canopy different from obviously what you'd had
with
the Hurricane?
Yes, it was. And indeed, we flew with them closed in the Spitz. Hurricanes, we nearly always flew with the hoods open. I'm not absolutely certain why. It was felt at the time that you could see better without the canopy. Well, that's because the Perspex canopy used to get heavily scratched and marked, and distorted the vision, or made it feel as though you weren't seeing so well. And moreover, you could fly a Hurricane with the hood open perfectly happily. There'd be a certain amount of buffeting, but nothing very extreme. And it didn't seem to affect the performance of the aircraft in any way. And up to 15,000 feet, you're quite comfortable. But then the cold started to get in. And nearly always, if you're climbing up in a formation, by the time you got past 12,000, you see people slamming their canopies shut. And... oh yes, it got unbearably cold above that height, so we always had them shut. Spitz, on the other hand, you had the thing open and shut from takeoff to landing. It was more of a bubble. You could move your head around inside it. The Hurricanes were rather close sides to the canopy, but the bubble on the Spitfire was good. And of course, the later marks of Spitfire, where it's just one big bubble. That must have been sheer joy. I didn't fly any of those advanced Spitfires. I think 14 was the last one I flew. But it was nice. You had got plenty of headroom. You could turn around. You could see what was over your shoulder, which of course you couldn't do with the Hurricane. You got the armor plate immediately behind you, and you couldn't see past it. And you couldn't get your head out the side to look around at either.
And with the performance of the Spitfire 5B, would it have a better performance than the Hurricanes that you'd flown prior to that? Would it attain a higher height or?
Oh yes, yes, yes. It all round performance was better. Yes, both in terms of maximum speed, had another 30 miles an hour over a Hurricane. Rate of climb was that much better. It was a lighter aircraft with the same engine, therefore it could climb faster. Maneuverability. We always felt that the Hurricane was more maneuverable, and I think it probably was. But it did vary the height. I think... the Spit, of course, could go on higher, and therefore you get a better performance or higher altitude than you would with a Hurricane. Considerably so.
And your conversion, obviously, from Hurricane to Spitfires, how did that take place? Did you?
Oh, very simply. The boss called us together in the tent. Sabala was the name of the airfield, La Sabala, about 10 miles from Tunis. Hey, Mia.
Hello.
Do you want any help? And he just called us together and said, right, we're re-equipping the Spitfires. We all looked at each other. I don't think anybody cheered, no. You know, we all just looked at each other. Oh, all right, okay. He said, get your Hurricanes. Flight commanders will give you each a Hurricane to take back. And we're going to Sétif, which is... About 300 miles to the west, and there you'll get your Spitfire fives and bring them here to Sabala. Any questions? That was it. Now, I feel sure that. We must, somewhere along the line, we must have been given some pilot's notes. On the other hand, it may be that they forgot to pack them and they never got to North Africa. I can't remember.
At that stage, I take it wouldn't have presented much of a problem going from one aircraft to another.
Oh, no. No, it wouldn't. No, nothing. There was a very, very little difference. As long as you remember the bit about taxiing, I think... you could quite easily hop from one to the other. After all, the 80s girls used to hop from Spitfires into Lancashire without batting an eyelid.
The layout, you mentioned obviously in the cockpit that it would wrap around you. Would everything be roughly in the same position as a Hurricane?
Yes, pretty well. I say pretty well. Certainly the... what we call the blind flying panel. It's a six-instrument layout of airspeed indicator, altimeter, artificial horizon, directional gyro, rate of climb indicator, turn and bank indicator. It had those six instruments. And that was a standard panel, which in fact went into all aircraft after a certain date. All RAF aircraft had that same panel. Then you'd have your engine instruments, Hurricane... and the Hurricane, you had rev counter, oil temperature, oil pressure, radiator temperature. Then you'd have your oxygen controls up here. This side, and down here was the radio. Forgot what was the top left. Anyway, it was a regular pattern. Some of the switches would be in different places. I think the ignition switches were always down there. Throttle lever would be here in the same place. Air screw pitch control would be in the same place. You'd have your undercarriage control down here, same place. So, although it looked rather different, fundamentally it was pretty well the same thing.
And was there anything else that you would have to remember flying a Spitfire for the first time, other than the taxiing?
Mm-hmm. I don't think so, no. No, I think I'm sure we must have been given pilot's notes. I can't believe they would have omitted them all together. I can't remember reading them. maybe they gave me a copy and I never read them.
And with the aircraft, was the role of the squadron to remain the same?
Oh no, no. We then became a day fighter squadron. Yeah, that was the end of our. night operations. By this time, we got lots of bow fighters in North Africa, and indeed in Malta, I got bow fighters there then. And I think got back in the Canal Zone too. Yes, they had. They got bows in the Canal Zone. Well, there were quite a few about there by then. So our night activities were no longer. And we just became a day fighter squadron. We had to do a little bit of practice before we became fully operational, because we'd all been flying for a year or more, solo, single sorties the whole time, or most of the time. By now, the battle formations had been eventually accepted by the Air Ministry, and we flew the Finger Four formation.
Could you describe that to me?
Finger Four, just that. Section leader. My fingers aren't even. section leader is number two. Subsection leader, number two.
So the largest finger.
That's the section leader, yeah. Next to him is his number two. So those two can be split off. And the number three and the number four, they can be split off. But that's how you would normally fly. Now when you go into a turn, they slide under there.
So the two outlying
fingers would slide. Yeah, the two on the inside of the turn come up on the other side. Go into the turn like that, and then they come up on the other side like that.
So they drop underneath.
That's right.
And lift up on the other side. So you continue to maintain the four,
that's
the four
right.
finger position.
That's right. And similarly, turning the other way, you'll go underneath. Come up on that side. Yep.
So do they axis around really the leader and his wingman?
Yeah, that's right. And then 180 degree turn. Well, that's a 90 degree turn. 180 degree turn. He slips underneath and stays there in line astern, and then comes up in the same position. So he goes. Like that.
So over, drops down and around.
That's right, yeah. And then where he stays will depend on the sound position. So if he's flying this way and the sun's up there, he's flying this way, the sun up here, there's the sun, and they'll fly like that. Do a turn, and he'll come up.
So, if the sun is to the left, the wing leader will be flying slightly above the squadron.
the sun's up there. This section will always be above the other section. So he's not looking into the sun. The sun up there, it'll be the other way around.
So the invert, depending on the position
that's
of
right.
the sun.
So he can see him. Now, if they're like that and the sun's up there, he can't see him. He's looking into the sun.
Yeah.
If he can't see him, he can't see the enemy either. So he's got to be up there.
So these new tactics had finally been adopted, as you say, with...
Yes, at long last. And... we immediately, from the outset of the changeover, we immediately became a day fighter squadron, and employing this type of battle formation, as it was called.
To a certain extent, with your experience in Malta, less so in the desert, but had unofficially those formations been adopted earlier on by different squadrons?
Unofficially, they had been, yes. I think from very early days, Douglas Bader insisted that this was how he was going to fly. Whether he actually did or not, I don't know. I never flew with him, but I believe he pleased himself pretty well how he flew his wing. Although by the time wings came in, it was then accepted. But of course, one got a bit out of touch with what was happening at home, having been away for so long. It was all a bit of a strange new world coming back here. And so we got the Spitz, and then we waited for the attack on Sicily to commence. And so September 43 came along. We'd been spending a few weeks, like the rest of the armies and air forces, in the Western Desert, dusting ourselves down, having kicked the Africa Corps for six, as Monty put it, out of Africa, and settled down to a few weeks of general tidying up, reorganizing, and leading rather civilized lives. 73 Squadron, having reverted from night operations to day operations, were then leading civilized hours, i.e. going to bed at night and getting up in the morning instead of vice versa. The invasion of Italy, and first of all Sicily, was obviously not far off. But before that could be done, the island of Pantelleria, which was a fortress in the straits of Sicily, had to be dealt with. It was expected that it was heavily fortified, and that for once the Italians might put up quite a fight, since we were getting dangerously close to their homeland. And preparations were made for a mighty onslaught on this island. It started up with heavy bomber raids by big formations of American B-17s, softening up, and preparations were all in hand for landings when virtually the defense collapsed and the troops moved in virtually without any trouble at all. So that was out of the way. We'd had a few skirmishes with the Spitz, but generally the enemy activity, air activity, over the area was negligible, which was rather good because it meant that 73 Squadron were able to assimilate themselves with present-day day fighter tactics, which had changed considerably since my days in Malta. We were now flying the full-blown battle formation, which was known as the Finger Four, made us much more flexible in the air. Everybody could see what was going on all around them. It was obviously a much more efficient system, and a great pity it hadn't been introduced a lot earlier. One evening in the mess, the CO said to me, "Oh, I think you're probably coming along for posting shortly." And lo and behold, within 2 days, a posting came through for myself and five or six others. And also in the same message, the squadron was given 40 FCs, which went to the longest serving members. My posting was to number 73 Operational Training Unit, based at Abu Suair, in the Canal Zone. And three others came along with me. We were poured into the back of a Dakota and flown to Abu Suair.